Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with Meredith Bragg. He's the managing editor of Reason TV, and Jim Epstein, the deputy managing editor of Reason TV. We've recently celebrated 10 years being online. Reason TV launched in October of 2007. It's also Webathon week at Reason, and we are asking people who like the stuff that we put out, including Reason TV, all of our videos and our podcasts, to help pay for it by making fully tax-deductible donations to Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this website, this video platform, this magazine, Reason Magazine, the magazine of free minds and free markets. Please go to reason.com/donate and give what you can. It's the thing that keeps us going. Meredith, let's talk about
Nick, this is like you, Meredith and I are actually on mic. It's like you took, we've been peeling potatoes in the basement and now we're actually invited to, be in a public forum. It's amazing.
God, you know, Jim, I was asking Meredith a question, but I appreciate the,
I'm
realizing how many people are going to be, depressed and disappointed when they realize that I'm male.
Yes, that's true.
Which I'm assuming.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay,
I mean, you were gender bending before it was cool.
Yeah. Well,
but we're not actually going to publish this podcast, right? This
is the odds are becoming internal. Slimmer and slimmer with every passing second, if you ask me. Meredith, what is for you, what's the unique selling proposition in the old David Ogilvy, the great ad man, we used to constantly talk about the USP of something, the unique selling proposition. And his big example was that, you know, the unique selling proposition of M&Ms were that they had the candy shell, so they melt in your mouth, not in your hands. What is the equivalent of Reason TV?
Yeah, this may fly against the very name of the publication, but I actually think that you get a much more emotional human factor in video than you do on print.
Yeah.
Or it's more difficult in print than in video. In video, it's, you know, you're watching someone telling their story, and you're watching.
We also help reach people who can't read.
And I'll gladly put myself.
In Trump's America, it seems like the visual is much more important than the literary, right?
That's true. And we obviously.
So we're dumbing it down.
We're dumbing it down for people like me.
Yeah. Now, you know, it's interesting when you talk about that. Some of our early videos that really had an impact, there was Drew Carey, who's a trustee of Reason Foundation and who came up with the idea of Reason TV, saying exactly what you're talking about, that, you know, the magazine and the policy shop do great jobs of reaching kind of people's minds. But what about the heart? You know, some of our early videos that were incredibly powerful were a series of videos of parents who had children who were killed during police stops. Oftentimes they were mentally ill people, might be schizophrenic, homeless, and through misunderstandings they would be killed. And watching, I remember watching that moment of like where parents were struggling. Oftentimes these were people who were very much into kind of law and order, were deferential towards the police, and they could not make sense of a world in which their harmless children were tased to death or beaten to death or left to die in a cell. And it's unbelievably powerful in a way that
you get a sense of the weirdos. And that is something that we kind of specialize at Reason. And I think
what do you mean by that, Jim?
For example, I'll talk about a story I did about a guy named Tom Trinisky, and I don't mean to call him a weirdo. He's an interesting guy, but he's a retiree who's been scanning old newspaper microfilm in his house in upstate New York, you know, for a decade now. And he's actually scanned more than, the Library of Congress has for its project. And it's sort of an interesting story. But, you know, you could write it in print. You could write an article about it. But to kind of get a sense of these characters, video is great because you hear their voices. You see them in their environments. I think that's a real advantage. I do want to point out, too,
you know, when we say weirdo, it's kind of equivalent to the way that, hippies in the late 60s would call people freaks. And that it's not a term
positive.
Of opprobrium.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no,
no.
It's actually a term of worship.
No, I mean, I think you have, Nick, you're fond of using this phrase, you know, the experiments in living.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we celebrate subcultures in a way because in some ways I think that's why I have the political worldview that I do, is because growing up, the dominant culture was not something I was particularly fascinated with. Mm. I grew up in indie rock and hardcore music, right, and DIY, and libertarians seem to fit with that.
It's kind of fascinating, too, I think, when you say we look at subcultures, I'm a big believer in this. I joined Reason in the early 90s and then became editor of the magazine in 2000. And I almost felt like what I was going to say is that there was no mainstream. I mean, for a couple of years in the 90s, the biggest selling category of music on Billboard was the alternative charts. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's exactly right. And that's delivering on a kind of libertarian promise of individualism and kind of voluntary groups and just kind of letting your freak flag fly and the experiments in living. And it's kind of glorious now. And in the 90s, I think we've worked past this, although we might be coming back to it. But a lot of people, particularly if they were well up in the establishment, the mainstream, whether we're talking about entertainment or politics or culture or education, they were worried by what they considered the disintegration of a common culture. I don't think we worry about that as much anymore. Yeah. I mean, there are some problems with it, but nobody's upset that, the number one rated broadcast sitcom is reaching, one-tenth of what the Beverly Hillbillies did in the late 60s.
Oh, I think there are, though. I think you still have people who, they glorify the past when there were three or four networks and everyone got their news from the same place. I mean, you still hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have stopped listening to those arguments because I've been hearing them for so long. But that whole idea that, we're like in a modern-day Tower of Babel and we can't share a common language.
Right? You ask those people if they would trade what we have now for that, and they'll invariably say no.
Yeah.
So I think it's
because you don't get Netflix and Amazon streaming. You don't get HBO doing shows that are just phenomenal and that could not exist, did not exist. We know this for a fact. They did not exist when it was just three network channels or a fourth. I mean, that was exciting in the 80s. I'm older than you guys, but when Fox Broadcasting started and, it was anchored by Married with Children and the Tracy Ullman show, which, brought the Simpsons to an audience, et cetera. It was, very exciting to, see the number of broadcast, national broadcast channels expand by such a large amount. Jim?
I just wanted to add also, video is a great journalistic medium as well because it's a very honest medium. You find if you're writing a story, you can make it sort of, every room is smoke filled. It's sort of like in a dark cavern. You can make dull characters interesting. You can describe how they look, et cetera. With video, it's like, no, it's just a, it's a brightly lit conference room. It's a guy.
Man,
it's
you
like
are
really
just full of shit.
When he talks.
Jim Epstein, are you kidding me? And I mean, like the whole, the history of photography and film is that it's the biggest bunch of lies of all time. I mean, although Matthew Brady photos from the Civil War were staged. Robert
Kappa.
The lies
are hard to pull off. You have to actually plant the headless baby doll in the photo, and that takes effort.
The whole raising of the flag on Iwo Jima was like, that was the second take. How many times did MacArthur walk ashore at Corregidor? I mean, come on.
Yeah, but it takes effort, right?
So and writing doesn't take effort. You guys are video exceptionalists.
The truth.
It just happens. Jim, what are you? What is the work that Reason TV has put out that you're most proud of?
Oh gosh, there's so many. We put out 5-6 stories a week, and I'm proud of them all.
You're lying, but continue.
When I think about our best stories, and you want to talk about emotional stories, I think of Paul Dietrich's coverage, and there was it's actually a series of videos, but one on the killing of Kelly Thomas, mm-hmm. who was like a homeless drifter beaten to death by a cop in California. Incredibly moving video. And also a story actually also that is so well suited to video because video is part of the story, the visuals, the fact that we saw the kind of visual evidence of what had been done to this man. And it couldn't be conveyed sort of in a.
Yeah, not as powerfully. And, this is part of, I think, one of my heroes in a kind of video or visual space is actually Brian Lamb, the creator of C-SPAN. And, you know, his great insight was to turn a surveillance camera on. I think what Will Rogers said was America's only native criminal class, which is Congress. But, you know, we live in an age of forced transparency, including of the police. And, you know, and when you think about what has emanated, I mean, there were instances of this before, but when the Rodney King beating was captured by a guy trying out a video camera early on in the days of handheld personal, you know, where you could own your own video camera, so much has changed. And with cell phone footage and, you know, people being able to repurpose found footage and like use it to make a case against power or against the status quo. And I think that's what Paul's work, you know, as much as the exact story he was telling or stories were heartbreaking and important, the fact like is that it's a demonstration project of this medium of decentralized, cheap, you know, video capabilities.
The other thing I want to mention is our in-depth interviews, I think, are – I think about actually Zach Weissmuller's interview with Cody Wilson. That was terrific. Justin Monticello's George Hotz on self-driving cars. I mean, it's like we – sometimes these interviews go 40 minutes, an hour. They're incredibly in-depth, and they're not kind of the sycophantic Charlie Rose model. I mean, I like some Charlie Rose. Well, actually, Charlie Rose is a separate topic altogether at this point. But
yeah, let's not talk
I like
about
some
Rose.
Of those interviews. But I think that we, you know, we challenge, we play devil's advocate, we get really in depth, and I think it's something unusual.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating to me that you know, and I guess this is like if you you hear stories about how like Welsh people. You know, they finally get to leave Wales where they're like in shitty coal mines for, you know, eons. And then they come to America and inevitably they settle in the Appalachians or the Kentucky Hills and they start mining coal again. And it's like, you were just set free, Barabbas. Like, would you go out and do something differently? And I think a lot about that with where we are in video, where it's like we've been set free from a broadcast news and a cable news model of like, 2-minute, you know, superficial interviews where people are barking at each other, giving, you know, party lines and, you know, just bullshit. But that's what you see again and again. And people are like, oh, well, nobody wants to watch anything long. And in fact, this is like we have so much space and so much time that we can actually develop stories and have conversations, which bizarrely enough, if you go back and you look at even shows like Dinah Shore or Mike Douglas in the early 70s, they had longer, more substantive conversations with people than, you know, than we do now on, you know, most cable channels or even on most YouTube channels. So
yeah, I'm looking at our top 15 videos of all time on YouTube, and number 3 is an interview with Adam Conover.
Yeah, of Adam Ruins Everything.
Yeah, Penn Jillette's up there, yeah. Dirty Jobs. And I got to say, like the Ken Burns interview that you did, I think that's actually kind of emblematic for a couple reasons. One, it's a really good interview. Mm-hmm. It's a deep dive into a topic. This is one about the Vietnam that and his documentary series about Vietnam. People may not see, but 6 years ago we interviewed him about his Prohibition series. Right. And there was a moment that got a little heated and contentious in that interview about PBS funding and some other things, which, you know, naturally was going to come up in a conversation. Right. But it was a long interview. We treated it fairly. Obviously, he wasn't terribly offended by the fact that we were pushing him on really what's his bread and butter in a lot of ways. Yep. He came back and, I mean, we left – again, even in the Vietnam interview, there's a little bit of tension there occasionally on some topics and some issues and, you know, how his vision of the world versus yours, Nick. But that's what I want to get out of it. Adam Conover is not a libertarian.
Right.
He's a skeptic. Basically a progressive skeptic. And we had a really – Zach Weissmuller, a producer out of L.A. who set that interview up, we had a really good conversation with him. And it's become a – probably the definitive interview with a huge internet star.
Right, yeah.
On YouTube, which is great.
Yeah, and this is us. I mean, obviously, Adam Conover has the True TV version of Adam Ruins Everything, which is kind of – it's like very much like Penn and Teller's Bullshit or Mythbusters. But yeah, he was originally an internet star, and this is something, and you know, and I say this, I'm 54, I'm old enough to remember, you know, an era of like very diminished or minimal TV choices, pre-cable, all of that. And it's kind of exciting that like, you know, PewDiePie, who recently, you know, who's the most subscribed YouTuber on the planet, he has like, I don't know, 50 or 100 million subscribers. He recently cited a bunch of Reason TV video about cultural appropriation and trigger warnings. But, you know, this is a guy who a lot of people in the world don't even know who it is, really. And, you know, he is a bigger star than any of the late night people, you know, and he's better known than most politicians, et cetera. It's like a fascinating world of possibilities. Meredith, you have you come out of a music background, but you also have spearheaded our viral videos, or what we call viral videos. Talk about, you know, these are parodies that are highly produced. The most recent one, I guess, which was gigantic, was our Game of Thrones, a libertarian edition of that. Talk about the potential for viral videos. What you know, other than getting a lot of views, what's the point of those?
Yeah, I mean, we talk a bit internally about the community that Reason is creating. And I see the viral videos of having a couple different reasons for being, one of which is just, you know, these are sometimes humorous, hopefully humorous, videos that there may be a couple insider jokes that libertarians would understand, and that's always fun to sort of wink with your audience. Mm-hmm. You know, we're a pretty Reason style libertarianism is a pretty optimistic, fun loving bunch of people, and so I think this helps undergird that. Also, I sometimes these, you know, specifically the libertarian edition of the Game of Thrones video or the Star Trek or Star Wars, mm-hmm. these are subcultures that exist online. We released this, I think, a few weeks or a week before the new season of Game of Thrones started. So we're able to sort of ride this cultural wave mm-hmm. in a way that if we were just reacting to the news, we couldn't do. So it allows us to inject our viewpoint, our world, hopefully in a sort of a soft sell, into culture, the people, into groups of people, large subcultures that otherwise may not want to wrestle with our ideas.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that Matt Welch and I talked a lot about in our book from 2011 and 2012, The Declaration of Independence, that politics is a lagging indicator of where American society is going, and that politics tends to certify a social consensus that has either already been reached or is about to. So we're interested in cultural production, both in terms of engaging with creative work, whether it's South Park or Game of Thrones or Girls or, I mean, you name it, all sorts of types of music, which are often, you know, creative expression is a flashpoint, you know, and I think I can honestly say, the Reason Magazine started in 68. I think we're the only publication in that period that has always been pro-free expression, you know, and against any kind of censorship. We don't in the end say, oh, this is good expression because we agree with it, but here's some bad expression we want to can. And virtually every other political magazine and political point of view does that.
I'd also want to add, we're talking a lot about YouTube, but on Facebook, comedy does very well. Yeah. People like sharing comedic videos. And I love reading the comments of these videos because, I don't know, at least one out of every 20 – I'm not a libertarian, but this is pretty funny. And They're sharing it with their friends. Like, that's the reason. I mean, That's why we want to do it. And also, I think humor is a good way to break down some sort of political walls that people build up. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to be mad at someone over net neutrality when you're laughing at a joke they made. That may actually be against net neutrality.
Yeah, I'm trying to.
It's a hard.
yeah, I mean, net neutrality.
It's comedy gold, right?
Yeah, it's antidote to laughter, right?
But I think, you know, in an age where there's so much polarization between Republicans and Democrats, You know, libertarians can offer another way.
Right.
And I think part of that is getting people out of their tribal mindsets. You can do that through comedy.
Yeah.
A little bit. You can cause some cognitive dissonance, which I really think is truly the most you can do with someone if they have a strongly held belief. I'm not sure you can flip a switch and turn them on the other side.
Yeah.
But I do believe you can cause a little bit of a gray, you know, maybe it's not so black and white in their minds, and that'll open the door to at least other possibilities.
Right. Jim, what do you see as we're gearing up another year of Reason TV. It'll be our 11th year. We are in our annual Webathon. We're asking people to support our efforts. You know, we created about 250 videos last year. We're coming up on YouTube alone. We're coming up on 100 million views over the decade that we've been around. Where do you see Reason TV kind of going over the next year or two? What are the topics and what are the genres or the treatments that we're going to be focused on, do you think?
In terms of topics, I mean, one thing we've moved into a little bit more in the past year, I think, is biohacking, kind of explorations in new ways of living, tech, cryptocurrency, not only talking about government policy, but actually talking about what is arguably more important, which is people who are just kind of exiting the political system and expressing themselves and doing things differently.
This is the kind of permissionless innovation that some people talk about.
So I think topically that's a direction we've been going in. In terms of overall, I think it's really just more and better. And I think what is exciting to me about Reason TV and our video project is that we're always getting better, both in the quality of what we're doing, the quality of our journalism, our numbers and reach. And I think that's really the goal.
You know, and we have a bunch of new products, too. And again, this is, you know, to hammer home the idea of donations. Reason is published by a nonprofit. It's a 501c3. When you give money to it, it's tax deductible. We're what's considered a research and educational organization. And that is essentially what we're trying to do is we're trying to come up, find new stories and educate people about an alternative way to view the world that's not it's not about power being aggregated or arrogated in smaller and smaller numbers of people, but rather disseminating that and creating, decentralizing power, decentralizing information and authority and the ability to live how you want to pursue happiness on your own terms. So all those donations help us undergird all of that. You know, one of the things, Meredith, that I would like to ask you about is, talk a little bit about how you, where you came from. You've been running Reason TV for a number of years now. You have a minor cult in kind of indie music scenes. Talk a little bit about where you came from and how that melds into working at Reason.
I played indie rock music for a while.
You grew up in the D.C. area,
yeah,
mostly?
Yeah, going to hardcore shows.
So this is like at the fabulous 930 Club and the legendary Black Cat.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And, there was a very strong do-it-yourself ethos. Yeah, there was a very strong do-it-yourself ethos.
And you are how old?
I'm 41.
Okay, and so we're talking about here the 90s.
Early mid-90s, yeah. And that struck me. I mean, people were making their own way in the world. They weren't trying to in essence, they had rejected what was being played on the radio and the way that, I mean, Ticketmaster and other people were putting on shows. And they started doing it themselves, making their own T-shirts, printing their own records, making their own posters, playing in their own bands. And it was a lovely time to grow up as a kid in D.C. Mm. I mean, it was really special, and that stuck with me. And I liked the idea of people being able to create their own utopia, and that there being that there is not a single utopia. There are many of them, and people have different desires and wants and needs, and that's probably what helped frame my worldview more than anything else.
Was there a tedious element to that, though, of I'm not sure when you kind of came of age exactly or the subset you were in of like, oh, the most important thing is don't sell out. Like, so I was into music in the 80s, especially because I was younger then. And I remember both U2 and REM, who became the two basically the biggest rock bands of the 80s. They started out on what were considered minor labels, and it was IRS and Island Records. And each of them were touted as, you know, what's great about them is they're indie. They're on alternative labels. And then each of them sold out. And at the time, I think they each brokered the single biggest deal in record history. And then they put on the back of the record support independent music.
Right.
And that was like, people were like, I can't fucking believe these guys are sellouts. Was that still a big thing there? And how do you feel about that? Because
it was, but at the same time, I don't ever, I mean, I'm, yes, it was definitely there. But it was not something I subscribed to. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, every teenager had to start at, you know, a failed zine at one point.
Right.
So I had a single issue of a failed zine that I would never do
what
again.
What was it called?
I refuse to tell you.
I'll tell you my most embarrassing childhood thing is I had a college newspaper column called The Gordian Knot.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Mine was called Eat.
Is it available online, Nick?
No. This was in the Rutgers Daily Targum, which, like every every college newspaper, claims to be the oldest college newspaper in America. They have not seen fit to put my archives online.
But I remember I interviewed Jawbox, who had just jumped from Discord, which is the local DC record label, to a major label. I've forgotten which one. And I believe it came up in the interview, but it was I always wanted – I always thought the music I was listening to was the best music.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I want more people to listen to better music?
Right.
So I never quite understood the push against trying to get it wider distribution by having –
Well, and this is – like you mentioned Ticketmaster. I remember when Pearl Jam – you know, like – and again, I remember the Pleistocene era where in order to get tickets, you would listen to your favorite radio show and they'd say like, oh, you know, Bruce Springsteen tickets are on sale. Go to your local Steinbach's, or you had to go to the venue to stand in line for days or overnight to buy the tickets. Ticketmaster solved that. And then Pearl Jam was like, you know, these motherfuckers are taking a cut and they're costing our fans, so we're not going to work with them. And they inconvenienced their fans ultimately by saying like,
I was not a Pearl Jam fan. Yeah. I applauded that move because why not? They get to decide.
Oh, yeah.
Their fans probably appreciate it. Ticketmaster was charging ridiculous prices.
No,
I remember having to go to Macy's.
It was a service fee. It was a service fee. And it's better.
It was a grotesque. Yeah. It was overcharging to the point that the marketplace said this is too much. And Pearl Jam said, I'm going to do something different.
Yeah. And we're going to make you actually go and stand in line for your fucking tickets. I mean, it wasn't like they weren't making it easier for the fans. It was what a cheap
I have no problem with what Pearl Jam decided.
God, I can't believe I work with you. You know, why don't you just join a commune? Jim, what was your path to, I mean, you are a second generation, like, movement libertarian, right? And you worked at Channel 13, which you never shut up about, as if it's, you know, like anybody cares, especially with Charlie Rose, you know, going down like the Titanic. How did you get involved in video and journalism, and how does that all fit into the Reason job that you do now?
Sure. Yeah. I got out of college and was kind of a New York history obsessive, which still works its way into my video sometimes. Thought I was going to go to history graduate school, started that, and was like, I'm going to end up dying in the stacks and no one's going to ever read what I write. Then I got a, right after September 11th, I got a job kind of as a like an interim researcher at Channel 13. I had no video experience and I ended up learning on the job and staying for 8 years. And it was a great gig. You know, I learned we were short. We didn't have a lot of money. We had these new cheap video cameras, starting with the VX1000, the PD150, about $3,000. They shot broadcast quality. And we were able, you know, I was kind of able to learn how to shoot just on the job. And I shot a lot of really, really hideous looking video. Did some really,
What show were you working
on? The main show I worked for was called New York Voices. It was a New York public affairs show. We did a lot of different types of things. We did a lot of education coverage, land use coverage. I was a libertarian working at New York's PBS station, which was obviously some cognitive dissonance. But I would get, my kind of boss and mentor there, who had come from the NewsHour, knew my politics, but he was very devoted to kind of two sides of the story always. So I would, you know, I'd get to I did some pieces I was proud of, but coming to Reason, it was an opportunity to really you know, call it like I see it. And from my perspective, you know, tell the truth about what, or my best interpretation of what's really going on. But I, the other thing is like at Channel 13 and, you know, by the, you know, 2007, the web video was starting. We had a web video department. I was sort of always jealous of those guys. I thought it was kind of exciting. And then when I came to Reason, I remember the first video I uploaded, I remember hitting publish on YouTube for the first time. And it was, you know, at that point in my career, I had produced, you know, countless, you know, dozens of segments and half hour shows on traditional broadcast in New York City. And it was like, wow, like this is the big show. Like this is so much, it's scarier, it's more meaningful than the old way of doing it. One reason was like I published the video and immediately comments started to come in, which is like kind of nerve-wracking because like, oh my God, it talks back to you.
What was like, the video?
It was a piece I did with you actually, which I probably don't want to go back and watch, but it was a thing about predictions on Mad Men.
Season 3 yeah, or 4, the new
teasing
season.
Out some of the libertarian themes in Mad Men. I remember I think I made kind of like a crappy audio edit, and I think the first comment was like, audio edit at,
you know, well, do you agree?
And I was sort of horrified because it's like, wow, like that, you know, it, people are commenting, you're seeing the numbers tick up. I mean, we used to get ratings, but it was always sort of like, you know, it wasn't that precise, and it had a lot to do with the show that was leading in. So you could always sort of, if a show you worked your butt off on didn't do well, you could kind of rationalize it. And that's not true online. You know, you get detailed analytics. You have a much more intimate relationship with your audience. And in that sense, it is just objectively better.
Yeah.
The other thing is, it wasn't that piece, but by the time I did my first documentary, which was a piece on Detroit Light Rail, I remember someone wrote a blog post about it. And I was like, wow, like this, you are, when you work online, you're part of this conversation. And I never got that in working in broadcast. It was like you put it out there, you feel good about yourself, and then you do the next, you know, you basically declare success on your own terms, and then you move on.
I was going to say, I'm reading the comments. Jim and Crawdaddy 79 7 years ago
says, oh,
good
shit.
Summary. Next time, turn down the background music so we can actually hear you. Although I do want to also let you know that just a couple years ago, someone wrote, wow, libertarian hackery masking as television criticism. How savvy. You're going to review Game of Thrones next. So, you know, it's a good callback to.
Yeah, it's, you know, that leveling of producer and consumer, which I think is, you know, part and parcel of, you know, a massive shift that is, you know, is ongoing and has been ongoing, you know, at least back to Gutenberg and the printing press. Where, you know, the people who are being lectured to can suddenly start to speak back. And, you know, in places like YouTube and Twitter, I mean, one of the gestures that I think is paradigmatic or exemplary of our current moment is whenever you see the Dalai Lama tweet something, there will be immediately 50 comments saying, like, go fuck yourself, Dalai Lama, you know, or, you know, go back to Tibet, you son of a bitch.
And only 49 of those you wrote.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, well, you know, I can't do them all. But no, but it's, you know, that leveling of discourse. And it is horrifying to a lot of people because if you're used to being up at the top of the pyramid, you know, like the pharaoh has a lot to lose when, you know, the slaves or the citizens can start calling their own shots. And you
but
see
as libertarians,
that.
We've never been at the top of the pyramid.
Well,
so
yeah,
we're
it's true. Yeah, no, it's true. And it's
we really have a thick skin.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's you know, it is truly humbling when you see people both read your stuff and take it seriously, and then also how quickly people tune out. And, you know, people may not know this if they don't have their own YouTube account, but, you know, they have very comprehensive analytics, and you can see exactly when the average person stops watching. And, you know, Facebook has something similar. And it's like, man, you realize that, you know, you really have to work to hold people's attention. And this is what's fascinating to me as somebody who was into rock music. I mean, and that was kind of probably the first genre of art that I was really into, where, you know, artists would often disdain their audiences or ignore them. And it's like, you really can't do that anymore. And it's a fundamentally wrong dynamic to be like, you're either placating your audience and sucking up to them, or you're dissing them. It's much more of a conversation, and everybody is equal. And it's you know, Jim, as you were saying, it's better. You know, it's better. It's harder because you can't like fall back into your fantasy that, oh, well, everybody loves this. It's just nobody saw it or nobody wants to admit it.
Yeah, but at the same time, I do think that, you know, I'm the king of terrible analogies, and I always use this analogy of Reason TV is not a single video. It's not a stream of videos. Mm. It's a plate of different things on that plate, yeah. And people can choose what they're going. So some sure. people may want the, like when we talked about Ken Burns, that's a long, hour-long interview about the Vietnam War. That it's great. I loved that interview.
Oh, and the series is like 19 hours long.
Right. So we have 200,000+ people have watched that video. Right. That's fantastic. Then we have incredibly short viral pieces that are, you know, Remy video. Right. I mean, we should definitely bring, or a video that Austin did, right? Austin Bragg, who is really excellent at the viral videos. You know, the people who are watching one may not watch the other. Right. The point is not always to serve the same thing to, I expect the audience to shift. And some people may really be into a certain kind of video and not be into another. And really, it's about variety and different things. So while, yes, I agree that we're looking at things, and sometimes you see an audience go down. Like, okay, well, you know, this lengthy interview about Bitcoin didn't do as well as this Remy rap parody, you know, of Michael Jackson's Thriller. That doesn't mean we only do Michael Jackson Thriller videos.
Right, yeah.
Right, and I think that's important, is we're trying to give – in fact, the podcast, I think, is another example of that. It's offering something else to people, a deeper dive that maybe we wouldn't – you know, this is not a conversation we would have on video and post on YouTube.
Well, and this is a good moment to step in, and I'm going to ask Jim about the podcast in a second, but we're on the podcast. This is Reason's Webathon Week. We're asking people to donate to help us pay for things like our podcast, which goes out about 3 times a week. We're in the top 200 news and politics podcasts on iTunes. We're growing in leaps and bounds. Listen to it. If you like it, subscribe to it. And if you subscribe to it and like it, help us pay for it. It really helps. It is the difference between our voice being out there, raising concerns, bringing news to you if you're a libertarian, or representing the libertarian viewpoint in all kinds of national discussions about politics and cultures and culture and ideas. Jim, you were pushing for a podcast for a long time. What, you know, in general, what does the podcast genre or format, do you think, what's its value? I mean, it's exploding. I mean, it's, you know, almost 10 years old, I guess. But it's, you know, it's exploding. What's its value in general? And then what do you think is particularly good about the Reason podcast?
I think that, podcasting, now that we all have smartphones and headphones are on us all the time, it allows us to consume content in different places. You know, just to state the obvious things, it allows us to be quick on our feet. You know, when you produce video, when you want to talk to people who are far away, you got to get people there. You got to shoot it. You got to edit it. Podcasting is fast. We can be reactive. We can be really on the news. I think Just last week, Nick, your interview with FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai was terrific. It was the day where net neutrality was in the news. It was a great interview, and we had it up, you know, within hours. So in that sense, it's great. I mean, it's about kind of bringing Reason's editorial work and sensibility to a different medium. I think it's a really intimate medium.
It's kind of fascinating, isn't it? And I mean, radio has always been like that too, where radio disc jockeys or you know, radio talkers have, you know, this intensely intimate bond, which is more so, it seems, than a TV host. And that definitely is a big part of podcasting. And maybe it's partly because you can be listening in an intimate setting. It's spoken directly into your ear, but
you draw the pictures in your head.
Yeah.
You don't have to, you know, see what the people actually look like. It's
again, but what you like about video is that there's no fakery involved, Jim. I don't, you're just right, a mess right. of, you know, discrepant impulses.
He's a complicated man.
It is, you know, I think it is like this new frontier in the digital disruption of media. It's like, you know, we had a print magazine before I came on board for a long time, and then we had a website, and it's like our reach, our impact just increased by orders of magnitude, and that's great. But then, you know, with, as Meredith was saying, it's like Reason TV, it's a balanced diet. It's like a whole TV channel. And we had a TV station, and now we have a radio station, and I don't know what's next, but it's exciting.
I think it's probably going to be a swingers club. You know, I'm not saying I want that to happen. I'm just, you know, I'm just calling it as I see it. But, you know, as we wrap up here on the Reason podcast during Webathon week, please go to reason.com, donate, make a tax deductible donation if you can. We had at some point when we were talking about doing this episode, you know, I wanted to open the floor to questions from you guys.
Yeah, good.
You know, and now the hunted.
I was about
is
to
the
interrupt.
Hunter.
Yeah, because so, you are the editor-in-chief of Reason TV.
That is correct.
Yes. So you've been here since the beginning. I'm curious.
Not quite, actually.
Really?
Reason, Drew Carey in the spring of 2007.
We should talk to each other more.
It's surprising. But Drew and the project got started in the spring, I guess, of 2007, where first hires were made and, you know, film or, you know, footage shot and all of that kind of stuff. And then we launched publicly in October of 2007. I became editor-in-chief in January of 2008. And that was partly because I was editor of the magazine. We brought Matt Welch in to do that. And I moved over fully into the online space, both Reason.com and Reason TV. So very close to the beginning, but not actually there. And the first couple of people who were here, I mean, the two staff people who were biggest were the first, you know, number one and number two Reason staffers were Paul Fine, who produced the Reason Saves Cleveland series, which was a finalist for a National Magazine Award, a very nice honor. And Ted Balliker, who has gone on to create his own production company, and he did the great documentary Can We Take a Joke, as well as the forthcoming narrative film about feature film about Suzette Kilo and eminent domain abuse that's going to be in theaters in 2018.
So I am curious to know what you expected in 2007 and what has surprised you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because it for me, I still am kind of like when I think about the amount of writers that we could hire for the amount of money that it takes to do video, I'm kind of like, you know what, I'm a text exceptionalist. You know, I mean, I think it all begins with words and thoughts that are expressed in words. And I think, you know, that's, you know, I think the word is still the killer app of human
The big
existence.
Reveal at the end of this interview is that we're fired.
Yeah, that would be, you know, well, now you've ruined it, but spoiler alert. But no, but beyond that, it's that I am pleasantly surprised. And I mean, this is very much gratifying, you know, and it's actually you guys and the staff at Reason TV, who I think are just exceptional. I am surprised that more people are not doing actual journalism in online video. Too much of it is just, it's not even substantive conversation. It is aping the dying embers of cable or of, you know, TV stuff where, you know, we've been set free. It's Juneteenth. Like, we don't have to, you know, do shitty versions of CNN or Fox News. We don't have to do 5-minute conversations. And like, you know, online, there's no reason for anybody to ever say, oh, well, we're about out of time. And yet you see that again and again. And I think it was Marshall McLuhan said that any new medium spends its first like 25 years
imitating
the one that it just replaced, or, you know, in a more common parlance or current parlance, as Jim was using, disrupted. And, you know, I'm surprised more people aren't doing that. And also that they don't understand that journalism is not merely like pointing a camera and taking footage. It's telling a story that comes with a point of view and with information, not necessarily news, but information that needs to be told. So in a way, that's surprising that there aren't more stronger versions at magazines that are similarly situated to us.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about sort of my music background, but, you know, before I came here, I was at ABC and the Washington Post. So obviously, Jim and I come, you know, to Reason with a long journalism yeah. history.
Right.
And so I definitely think that that is something that we have tried to push on every, because some people who are, you know, hired recent yeah. TV, maybe they're into video and they've come straight from college.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
In some ways where, you know, we're a teaching hospital, right? I mean, yeah. we're teaching people how to use the equipment, how to edit.
I think we're more of a mental hospital, but yes.
Yeah. Maybe not, maybe on yeah. the word side.
Yeah.
But so I definitely think that we have pushed that idea.
Yeah.
And also, unlike words, it's really hard. If you get something wrong on video,
yeah.
it's really hard to do anything except take it down or offer some sort of really clumsy
right.
Change in the text.
Adaptation or whatever.
Yeah. It's yeah. so we have to work hard to make sure that we're doing everything we can to get it right.
Yeah.
And I think I am I think most journalists worry about the day they get something wrong by accident. And I worry about that stuff. So we are very diligent about checking. Well, what did the other person say? Did you reach out to this? Did you? So
well, this is also, you know, this is the like the deep DNA of Reason for 50 years. And certainly when I joined in 93 under Virginia Postrel, the editor of the magazine who hired me, part of the whole idea, and this is also something Penn Jillette has said when he was doing Bullshit, that you know, you want to represent the best of the arguments that you're engaging. Like, you don't want to take, like, the shittiest, you know, lefty or the shittiest case against gay marriage or the shittiest case against the minimum wage or in favor of the minimum wage. Like, you want to engage the best and represent it fairly. And I think that is definitely what, you know, the ethos of the print or the text journalism. And I think it's also true of video. And it makes for better stuff because, like, in the end – we're trying to give people enough, like, to show our math so that they can check our figures because we're going to be wrong sometimes.
And we talk about it when we interview people who are of similar mindsets,
yeah.
you know, that we need to take the best arguments and, you know, there are ways to confront these people with hard questions from yeah. the other side. And that by doing so, not only are you elevating the conversation, but you're respecting the guest because you have – you trust that they know their stuff well enough
right.
that they will be able to respond and react to the best arguments from other points of view.
Jim, do you have a particularly uncomfortable question that you want to ask me?
Yeah, for public consumption.
Yeah, no, so. You know, and while you're trying to come up with something, I mean, do you have any Charlie Rose stories to tell from your Channel 13 days?
I was not. Well, Charlie Rose actually, excuse me, broadcast from Bloomberg Studios. He was actually produced by Channel 13. But I had not heard specific sexual harassment stories, but I had heard other stories about Charlie Rose being sort of a despicable human being. So I was not totally surprised when that scandal broke. Trying to think, Nick. I don't know. I was going to say, I think another thing about the video work that we do, and I think there's a variety of reasons for this, is that we're also a little bit less married to the news cycle. You know, mm-hmm. we're always looking for stories that nobody's paying attention to things that are underreported. I think that happens in Reason generally.
Right.
But it's particularly true with video.
Yeah, and it has to be, right? Because it's very rare that you can really kind of turn on the dime and do certainly a kind of documentary or reported piece. It's going to take a while. So you have to look at things from a different perspective. I mean, we do fast reaction stuff, and sometimes that works really well. You know, and this goes to the earlier conversation about production values. One of an early hit for us, and this was before either of you guys were working here, it was at some point, this would have been in the early or late 2000s before the teens, but the government was saying, GM claimed that it had paid back in full its TARP loans, blah, blah, blah. And I was hanging around with one of Dan Hayes, who was an early employee who has his own production company at Freethink Media. I was like, that's such a bullshit story. And I scrawled a couple of notes on a piece of paper. That was the graphic, and he just shot that. We put it up, the whole thing, in about 45 minutes, and it did extremely well for us. But in general, you're right. I mean, it's like there's an investment in story production and development and then filming and editing. It's a lengthy process that's similar to writing a feature story for a magazine as opposed to, say, like a blog post.
Yeah, and it's an expensive. I mean, we'll do a lot of stories about small cities in the United States, for example, and we're not going to do that story unless we go to the city and spend a few days there getting to know the people. I mean, you can't just call people up.
So you're going to leave. You're going to exit on a note shitting on print journalism. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. Well. Yeah. More pictures. Yeah, pictures. With pretty music.
Yep, pretty pictures.
You guys are part of the problem.
Pretty music. Yeah. Big part of the problem. It's like, it's with video, because, you know, I do write articles as well, and I have to say video is, you know, objectively more difficult. It's also, you write the story, you've crafted it, and then the work has just begun.
Ah,
you know, got to figure out what to show.
Wow, you know, you have quite a martyr complex for a guy who is not even a Catholic or Protestant. You know?
I don't trust my writing, so I'm stuck with video and pretty pictures.
Yeah, okay, so there you go. And the occasional musical note. I think we have run out of conversation, unlike the national political conversation. We really have nothing of interest to say to a dwindling audience. So we'll end it here. This has been the Reason Podcast. This is our Webathon week. Please, if you like Reason TV and you want to see another decade of Reason TV, please help us out. Give us a tax-deductible donation at Reason.com. Donate. If you like the podcast, subscribe to it. Share it with your friends. Let's crack the upper reaches of the iTunes top charts for news and politics podcasts. And again, Reason.com/donate. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.